special committee on budget. Today is our first, maybe last, we don't know, meeting of this particular committee. On our agenda is the adoption of committee rules, followed by a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 5075. Let me ask the members if you've had an opportunity to review the committee rules, the proposed rules. Is there a motion, Representative Johnson?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. I'd move adoption of the rules as presented.
Representative Johnson moves approval of the adoption of the rules as presented to the committee. Is there a discussion? Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, the rules are adopted. We now ready to proceed with a public hearing on House Bill 5075. Mr. Rocco, do you have any preliminary comments?
Mr. Chair, I could summarize the bill for the committee. The House Bill 5075 takes the actions that would be necessary to implement the emergency care package that was proposed by the Speaker to restore certain budget reductions resulting from the failure of Ballot Measure 28. The bill includes restorations of reductions in the Department of Human Services and State Police in the total amount of $15.5 million. Revenue to restore these reductions are from the projected lottery fund ending balance from tobacco master settlement agreement funds that were previously allocated to the Insurance Pool Governing Board. From additional unanticipated tobacco tax revenue and from amounts remaining unallocated in the emergency funds. The Department of Human Department of Human Services restorations total $14.3 million, and they restore services through the end of the biennium for 122 residential beds for individuals with mental illness. They restore long-term care services to elderly and disabled persons in priority levels 10 through 14, and they restore cuts made to the medically needy program. In the state police, the total restorations are $1.2 million, and they restore 40 patrol positions, troopers, and 40 positions in forensics and other forensic services. And again, these are also through the end of this biennium.
All right. Is there a sign-up sheet? Representative Johnson?
Mr. Chair, thank you. A question for Mr. Rocco. This is all the forensics facilities, Mr. Rocco.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, no, it's roughly about half of the amount that was cut for forensics.
Other questions? If not, then we'll begin with the testimony on I'd open a public hearing on House Bill 5075. Representative Dalto, do you wish to testify?
Yes.
Please have you come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Billy Dalto, State Representative, Oregon House District 21. I just wanted to take a few moments this morning to show my support of House Bill 5075. From my first days on the job here at the Capitol, I've heard from dozens of people alarmed to have been cut from a program called Medically Needy. As you know, Medically Needy serves 8,000 people across this state. Many of whom are neighbors who need help paying the high cost of their prescription drugs. In some cases, these prescription drugs cost hundreds of dollars per month. One of my constituents, an elderly female, relies on more than 18 medications to treat her congestive heart failure and a litany of other maladies that she's facing. She earns about $650 per month, and from that she pays rent and car insurance and every other thing of of daily living. She can't afford her co-pays for her medications, let alone the actual cost of the medications, which is more than $700 per month. So this is a critically important program for her. Without these medications, this constituent of mine would lapse into heart failure and die. For thousands of Oregonians across this state, the prognosis is equally grim. Colleagues, I know that each of you feel the weight of responsibility for this great state's most fragile citizens. I know I have. Sitting on the Health and Human Services Committee, I often leave hearings with a heart heavy for the plight of many of our neighbors. That's why I'm so encouraged by Speaker Minnis' effort here through House Bill 5075 to mend the safety net that is about to break apart. It has been said that House Bill 5075 is a defining moment of the 2003 session. For our fellow citizens relying on the restorals contained in House Bill 5075, I believe it is. I came to this body with an intense desire to solve problems and help people. It's what each of us does every day, and it is exactly what House Bill 5075 does, and I urge its adoption today.
Thank you, Representative. Are there questions? Representative Hansen.
Thank you. Just a quick question. Are you personally committed to maintaining these same programs in the 2003-05 budget and urging us to, or maybe willing not to go home until we can find the funding to keep these programs going on into the next biennium?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, I do not sit on budget committees, and so I can't make a commitment about a budget vote that doesn't come, you know, that has not come out of the budget process yet, and nor will I lock myself into something for the session that we haven't gotten to. But I will tell you that these programs are critical. They are essential for the lives of many of the people in my district and many of the people across this state. And so I will do my best to be a strong advocate for funding in these program areas. I will testify. I will beat a drum. I will, you know, take to the streets to make sure that people who rely on the medically needy programs and those Medicaid priority levels 10 through 14 and even 15 through 17 are protected. And so I will do the best that I can.
Further questions? Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Flores and Smith, would you like to testify? I appreciate the indulgence of other witnesses here. I'm sure you would agree we want these people to give their testimony, leave the room, and get back to work in other places. We thank you for your understanding. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Miller, Vice Chair Morgan, members of the committee. For the record, I'm State Representative Greg Smith, representing the citizens of District 57, which is Union, Wallowa, Moro, and parts of Umatilla County. I just want to take a brief moment of your time and let you know how much I applaud Speaker Minnis and her support of House Bill 5075. The voters of Oregon, as you know, have spoken. They have said that they did not support ballot measure 28, and as a result of that, many necessary reductions were made. But I think if you go out and you talk to the citizens of Oregon, what they wanted us to do was to prioritize spending, to eliminate waste, and to redirect resources where they truly need to be directed. And I think House Bill 5075 takes a step in that direction in placing dollars where Oregonians would place most likely their priorities, and that's taking care of our most vulnerable citizens, our senior and our disabled, and stepping up for our state police who disproportionately have taken a great hit. I don't want to take a lot of your time. I think this is a very positive piece of legislation, and as a member of the House and as a citizen from Eastern Oregon, I applaud the Speaker and I applaud you, Chair Miller, for bringing this forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Flores?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Can we do questions
sure.
to the both of them? Thank you. Please proceed. No, you go ahead, Representative, and then we'll have questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, I am Linda Flores. I'm representative in House District 51, which is Clackamas, Damascus, Loring, and Estacada. I am here to speak in behalf of this particular House bill and encourage your support and adoption so that we can move it forward. The role of government is to determine and to protect what is the essential role of government, what are the services we should be providing, and protecting the protection of our citizens. I have a huge component in my district of the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, Clackamas, which has been a model of public-private partnership, and yet they are jeopardized by the cuts that have been made. And I have been hearing very loudly, very clearly from that component, as well as seniors in my district, as well as state troopers in my district. It is my feeling, from what I have heard from people, as well as my personal conviction, that as families focus on essentials in their budgets, so too must the government. And we want our government to do what it should do, not what it might do. And I think we have become a government of what we might do in the good times. This is a lean time, and I support this bill, this attempt to protect our citizens, the most vulnerable among them. And yes, I will advocate to continue the services that are essential and integral to the protection of our citizens. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for Representative Smith. You're a member of Full Ways and Means. Do you know the roll-up costs for the restoration of this $15 million in the 03-05 budget?
Chair Miller, Vice Chair Morgan, Representative Johnson, yes, I've been brought aware of those numbers. However, I would point out that I think it's very unconscionable in this true time of need that we would not take this very necessary step, and then we as a collective body with our collective intellect figure out how we're going to deal with that issue. Granted, this is a temporary measure, but this is a desperate time, and these needy Oregonians need our help.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Please proceed.
So, given the high roll-up costs and the fact that this only funds for 4 months, as a member of Ways and Means, what's your commitment to try to sustain these programs past the 4 months?
Chair Miller, Vice Chair Morgan, Representative Johnson, my commitment is to work hand-in-hand with you and the rest of the members of this committee and the Joint Committee on Ways and Means to make sure that we reprioritize Oregon spending to make sure that we're putting our money into public safety, into education, and into our most vulnerable citizens.
One more follow-up, Mr. Chair. When you mentioned education, I know how much K-12 means to you and how hard you've worked on it. Are you worried that there's no K-12 in these restorations?
Chair Miller, Vice Chair Morgan, Representative Johnson, that is a concern, but I think the intent of the speaker was to truly, truly take care of those most vulnerable Oregonians in this time of need, and so I support her in that effort.
Thank you.
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Many of the questions I wanted to ask have been ably asked and answered already, but I'm going to throw a few more at you here real quickly. From my point of view, in the last 3 days, this conversation has actually changed dramatically, and the change is that the 01-03 budget is now in danger. We were primarily concerned about the roll-up cost of this program and the need to take care of these people now, and I supported that, and I still do. I am very concerned, however, now about the 01-03 budget, the one we're sitting in, because we have a potential shortfall now of $300 million focused on the last 3 to 4 months in the biennium. If you were to take that and roll it out for the entire biennium, you'd be looking at close to a $1 billion shortfall. Knowing that, and knowing this is a new part of the conversation, and this $15 million looks rather small compared to $300 million we might be short, and probably are going to be short this biennium, what would you be thinking about as far as where we're going to go to balance this budget for 01-03, knowing that we're now facing very difficult choices concerning K-12, concerning corrections, concerning our public safety and other programs. This no longer, from my point of view, is going to solve the problem.
Chair Miller, Vice Chair Morgan, Representative Bates, I think your message is very accurate. You know, the fact of the matter is we are in a recession. Revenues to the state are down. Everyone's going to have to tighten their belt. We're going to have to make very difficult decisions. Primarily the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. But at the same time, I truly, truly believe that the citizens of Oregon have sent us here to reprioritize spending and to make sure that we're looking at what are those programs that are essential, what are those programs that are non-essential, and doing our best within our personal capabilities to make sure we redirect those dollars. And again, my commitment is to work with each and every one of you on this committee, the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, and this entire building to redirect those resources to Oregon's priorities.
Well, Mr. Chair, considering that K-12 funding is approximately half the budget, would you be willing to vote for a further cut to K-12 funding than this biennium?
Chair Miller, Vice Chair Morgan, Representative Bates, you know, that's a question that perhaps I would perceive as outside the dialogue of House Bill 5075, but it's a very important discussion that we need to have as a full committee on the Joint Committee of Ways and Means, and I'd be more than willing to work with you on that issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions? Thank you for your testimony. Appreciate it. Representative Barker, were you seeking recognition? No. All right. Thomas Cox.
For the record, my name is Thomas Cox. I'm the Communications Director for the Libertarian Party of Oregon. Honorable Chair, Vice Chair, distinguished committee members, thank you for allowing me to testify today. We meet here to discuss the proposals advanced by Speaker Minnis, but there is far more at stake here than a $15.5 million reversal of the worst cuts to the state police, the elderly, and the disabled. We meet today at a time and in a context that offers you an unprecedented opportunity to fix the problems facing our state. The proposal now before you does the right thing by reversing bad cuts that harm seniors and the disabled, but it does it in the wrong way because it cuts nothing. It cuts no programs. And programs must be cut, and you must cut them to undo the damage of House Bill 5100. There is a new revenue forecast coming, and it contains more and more and more red ink. You have only one option before you to handle this. You have to cut programs. My party, the Libertarian Party, has for 6 years released detailed budget after detailed budget proposing ways to cut programs. Let me describe just three right now that this committee could use to save money immediately. You must cut the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. The state has no business owning or operating any wholesale or retail activity. We can continue to license and enforce and fight underage drinking, but we serve none of those goals by having a state-owned warehouse in Oregon City storing millions of dollars of state-owned liquor. You must immediately replace the hidden wholesale markup of liquor prices with a revenue-neutral excise tax, and the reforms I suggest would raise more money for the general fund than the OLCC raises today, because every dollar we save by ending our wholesale monopoly flows into the general fund. In the next biennium, you should privatize the retail outlets currently controlled by the state, and you must rein in an abusive and out-of-control licensing enforcement division that has a track record of misuse of power, intimidation, ex post facto rulemaking, and selective enforcement. All of this abuse costs taxpayers money that would be better spent on schools and other key programs, but that's for later. You can end the wholesale monopoly today and save $16 million. You must immediately bring all possible pressure to bear, political pressure, on the PERS board to update the PERS mortality tables. Paying out money under assumptions that are known to be false, is nothing but fraud. Every week that goes by without that update, the state spends millions and millions more dollars than it needs to. An immediate update would save at least $50 million. In the current budget, and by some estimates even more. You must immediately institute a 4-day work week for middle managers not in public safety. That would save some $40 million in the current budget, and nobody would get a pink slip. Now, there are dozens of other areas where real cuts can and should be made: the Oregon Cultural Trust, SIM and CAM, the Oregon Children's Plan, the State Motor Pool. All of these and more should be looked into by you immediately. And as for Speaker Minnis' proposals, they are a good beginning, but I would urge you to find ways to pay for those proposals with real cuts. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions? Appreciate your testimony. Thank you. Joan Atchison?
I'm Joanne Atchison, and I'm a member of NAMI, and this is Ann He. She's our local NAMI president. I am a member, as I said, of NAMI. I'm also the parent of a son with mental illness, and his wife also has mental illness. These kids struggle. They try. They want to be independent. He started college and graduated with honors from Portland State after becoming mentally ill. They both work part-time as much as they possibly can, and without medical assistance for their prescriptions, which are extremely expensive. They face losing what they've gained. Even if they're able to get the prescriptions to scholarship programs, they still will not be able to get the medications, but they need prescriptions. And without a program such as Medically Needy, there is no way they can afford $120 a piece to go to a psychiatrist and get a prescription. So I urge you to consider that the programs that we have started that have helped people get on the road to having a full life, if they're quashed, we're going to throw these people right back down. And like most of us, there's only so many times you can climb up before you quit. So I urge you to consider maintaining programs and helping people that we have helped before. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Hi, I'm Ann Heath, and I'm the president of the local affiliate of the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. And I'm here because I appreciate Representative Menace's effort, because I think 4 months in the life of a person with severe mental illness without treatment is a catastrophe. And we don't have 4 months to wait around unless somebody comes up with something. And to tell you the truth, I don't care where the money comes from. I mean, I know you guys do, and I appreciate the tough job you have. But in particular, I'm concerned about people with mental illness who have their first psychotic episode and are not categorized as disabled yet, and maybe don't even want to be ultimately categorized as disabled, would like to remain in the workplace. The way the Oregon Health Plan has been set up, they've been able to get mental health treatment and maybe stay in jobs or get back into jobs and not have their life so totally derailed as it can be. Concerned about the mentally ill, homeless mentally ill, who there's a lot of outreach efforts go towards those people, but often they're very paranoid, and it takes a lot of effort to kind of bring them into shelters and help them then into treatment. And they are not about to apply for the federal assistance program. Maybe they will eventually, but really need in the meantime the services of like the HOPE Project here in Salem, which is homeless outreach. I'm concerned about the mentally ill people who have ended up in jails and prisons, which is at this point a default mental health system for a lot of our folks. I'm sure you're aware of that. Often within the state prison system, there is mental health treatment, and people get on medications, get into symptom management groups. But at this point, they will be released, not eligible for anything, and will not be on medication. And you know, I mean, you can just anticipate it. So it becomes a very expensive revolving door. I mean, we also want to plead the case that when these people fall back into services or get into a crisis, they're going to end up in the most expensive services. Kind of our most biggest fear is that some of them will actually die from suicide or from being unable to care for themselves and finding themselves in harm's way. And, of course, you know, I'm not saying that that's what people want, but it is the cheapest plan, I guess, if they just go away. But I don't think that's the way we really want to treat them. People with co-occurring conditions of mental illness and substance abuse, for some folks, they end up medicating themselves with with drugs or alcohol. And so we also think that it's very short-sighted to cut drug and alcohol treatment. I mean, I'm not here to really represent those folks so much, but many of our folks, when they're not on medication, and even some that are, will relapse, and they need a lot of support. I think mental health, there are a lot of very fine treatments. There's a lot of demonstration of projects. There's one here in town called the Early Assessment and Support Team. It's a unique program in Salem for young adults and first episodes of psychosis. There's a lot of kind of really outreach, and it's very successful to prevent people from ending up in kind of this disabled system that some mentally ill folks end up being in, hospitalized. They end up being on disability, living in a marginalized existence. So anyway, we urge you to come up with the money because okay. It's a crisis. So.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions from members? Thank you both. Appreciate your being here. Phyllis Rand.
Thank you. Good morning. Chair Miller and members of the committee, I'm Phyllis Rand, and I live here in Salem, and I'm the capital coordinator for the Governor's Commission on Senior Services. And I want to thank you for allowing me the privilege of testifying today. I'm here today to testify in support for House Bill 5075. The Commission is grateful to Speaker Menas for introducing legislation to restore some of the cuts that will negatively impact the lives of Oregon's most frail seniors and persons with disabilities. You have heard stories and you know what will happen to these people who are eliminated from these critical services. We hope that the legislature will pass this legislation before the next round of clients receive their notices in a few weeks. We believe that programs the speaker selected are among the most critical for the individual well-being of Oregonians' most frail population. We believe that House Bill 5075 is a terrific first step in minimizing the impact of these cuts. Thank you. Are there any questions?
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mrs. Rand, I know what a stalwart you've been in defense of senior programs. I've seen you here for years. The question that I have is what the Commission's position is on the fact that if this bill passes, that this is only a few months of restorations. Perhaps you could give the panel some guidance based on your knowledge of senior programs where additional cuts might come if in the 2003-05 budget we're not able to find additional money and there continues to be a declining revenue picture.
The Commission has talked about different ways to come up with money, and we've talked about a beer and wine tax and as another source of revenue. There have been some discussions about increasing the motor vehicles registration, but we haven't really taken a position on it. We've just had some discussions about it. And until this morning, the Commission's position has been that the money, particularly for the medically needy, would allow us some time to make arrangements to see that people can get some medication from other sources. It was not our intention that it would be, or we didn't think it would be possible to have that back in the 2003-05 budget, because we knew there were additional cuts coming.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have been told by some sources that the cuts that we're looking at to trying to restore here are really not the most acute cuts that we've had, and that there are people who have higher medical need and seniors with greater need than the ones we're talking about. Is that something that you share, or is it something that has just been given to me by people who don't understand the whole picture as well? As far as seniors are concerned, are these the worst cuts you're looking at, and do you think it puts people at risk for death?
The levels 10 through 14 are critical levels. They're a fairly high level of care that is required. Of course, 1 through 10 would be the most critical, you know. But people who are in level 10 require a lot of care, and it's my understanding that we have about 2,800 people in that level.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions? Thank you, Phyllis.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Jim Botwinis. Mr. Jim.
Mr. Chair, I'm not planning on testifying, but I'm supportive of this, so if there's any questions that relate to the chief's support of what Jim's about to say.
Thank you. Appreciate you being here.
Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Jim Botwinis. I'm the president of the Oregon State Police Officers Association. First off, I would applaud Representative Minnis's bill and getting this out, and Mr. Chair, yours and your committee's efforts for bringing this forward and allowing some public testimony on it. I provided some written testimony, so I'll just try and make my comments rather brief. This bill basically provides $1.2 million to the Oregon State Police. It brings back 40 patrol troopers and approximately 40 scientists. $500,000 of that approximately is for the troopers. $700,000 of it is for the scientists. Our concern, obviously, is multifaceted. One is that we have stripped the Oregon State Police down to a point that it simply cannot provide the services that it needs to be provided. We are already in the throes of reducing office hours in almost every station to no more than 20 hours a day. And many places will go to significantly less than that because of the staffing levels in the patrol division. And secondly, if we continue with the layoffs, basically, and we bring any of these folks back in the next biennium, the costs to bring those folks back are astronomical in comparison to the cost of bringing them back now, because we go through just extensive training for a period of 12 months for new people to come on board. And I'm sure these other agencies right now are liking us a lot, that the state of Oregon expended a lot of their taxpayer dollars to get our people to come to work for them. The other issue is that the patrol division, since we come out of the ODOT funding, basically has gone from about 650 troopers down to about 225 today, which is a huge number difference. And in some previous testimony and other committees I've provided, a piece that we looked at that seemed to become key to potentially working out on dedicated funding pieces is our number of troopers to population ratio. And before we laid off the 129 patrol troopers, of the four states that surrounded us, our ratio was already higher than those four states. We had one trooper for every 10,008 residents. Today, with 129 less, it's one trooper for every 13,795. Idaho has the highest ratio at one for 9,243. So we already were higher than the four states that surrounded us on a population basis before we laid off 129 troopers, and now it's really bad. We're also aware that on Friday, Homeland Security updated their security level from yellow to orange. We are extensively, as an agency, involved in the Homeland Security. This does not seem like an appropriate time to be laying off public safety people when we should be out there doing our job to protect the citizens of this state. And just as I'll just point out a couple of pieces here that to highlight what 129 fewer people will not be getting done. We will see about 2,000 fewer DUI arrests in a year. We'll see about 4,400 fewer truck inspections in a year. 7,200 fewer crashes responded to. 1,500 fewer warrant arrests. 3,300 fewer criminal arrests. Doesn't seem to me that is providing for the safety, either on the transportation side or on the criminal side, providing for the safety of our citizens when we allow 3,300 more criminals to roam around, or people who have outstanding warrants for major crimes to be running around. Trucks, obviously, people are very concerned about those monstrous grills coming up and eating up their back bumpers. Unsafe, a lot of them. And I don't think there's any of us in this room that would be too happy if one of those 2,000 fewer drunk drivers that gets caught in a year's time would be one that would crash into our family and kill a member of our family because we didn't have adequate people out there to arrest them and get them off the street to begin with. Be happy to answer any questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions? Representative Bates.
Thank you.
Chair. Every agency does not want to be cut, and you're no different, and I understand the vital services you apply to the state of Oregon, and I realize what you've gone through in the last 20 years, actually, and the cuts you've had to make. The question I would ask you is, we are looking at a huge budget shortfall for 01-03 and a bigger one for 03-05. And other than cutting other people's budget to give you more, there's no way out of this other than revenue. And that means a significant change in revenue. As an organization, as the state troopers taking a position on revising the Oregon revenue codes and raising more revenue to pay for what we consider essential services?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, we have not taken any position on the budget as a whole. I will tell you that we are concerned that for 20 years, even in the 90s when the economy was booming and there was lots of money in the state, the Oregon State Police, legislative session after legislative session, went downhill. There needs to be, from our perspective, and with all due respect, an absolute emphasis placed on public safety. I'm not against education. We must educate our children. I am not against taking care of our seniors, mentally disabled, etc. We need to take care of those people. But I think there is money in our budget that can come out of the budget for programs that are not needy right now when we don't have the money to take care of essential programs.
Hello, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bates.
This is the basic question we're all struggling with, and if you could provide us with a list of those agencies and specific cuts you think should be made so that we can properly fund Oregon State Patrol, I would like to see those cuts.
Okay, Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, I'll give you one. This is an example, and I'm not sure how much of this goes on, but I can tell you that I hear about it from our troops all over the state. The Oregon Health Plan has numerous people who come from out of state. They are in our state for 2 days. They get an Oregon Health Plan card. They get all their medical care taken care of. They get their dental work taken care of, and a week later, they leave our state. And I will give you an example of a family who was one of those who was just laid off in our organization, drawing unemployment, $1,200 a month, stay-home mom, kids with medical care, needs, went to get on the Oregon Health Plan. Guess what they were told? You make too much money, $1,200 a month. Yet we can have citizens coming from states all over this country coming in here, not a resident, not paying taxes, and use off that Oregon Health Plan here 2 days and start using off of it. That something is wrong with the system. That's not right.
Well, Mr. Chair, we've looked at that issue. I quite frankly tell you it's a minuscule amount of money, but it's some money. We're going to look at that further for eligibility. I would like to know if you could bring more substantial information to us that would talk about a $1 billion shortfall. And I'm not trying to criticize you here, but it's the same problem we're all facing, and everybody comes in saying, there's inefficiency, there's problems we need to solve, and yet when you get down to those problems and ask for specific cuts, even from our fellow legislators, we can't get the information we need to make those cuts. So at a later time, if you could bring to us specific cuts you think should happen or changes that should occur and how we deal with agencies and their budgets, please bring it to me. I'm glad to look at that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Let me just say about 2 years ago, I sat in this room with Mr. Bob Winnis, and I concur with his frustration, because 2 years ago, it seems like it was ancient history, we were in a fairly flush time with lots of new spending, and yet the state police were in for rather dramatic reductions, which I think didn't make sense to a lot of us at that time. And hopefully we can retrieve something for you in this bill.
Mr. Chair, if I may, real quickly, in reference to your comment, I've tried to start going through the 03-05 budget, the governor's recommended budget, to see where money, et cetera, is going there. And obviously, that's a huge document that's going to take a long time to get through. But the agencies I have seen so far, OSP, once again, is on the negative side of the column, and everybody around us is growing. Education by almost 8%. Human Resources wants to hire 500 new employees, and we're like minus 2.9% from the current biennium. So it is very frustrating to us, because we just keep seeing the same thing over and over and over. Everybody else grows, and we keep going backwards, and we don't understand that.
Thank you, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one item of concern that I wanted to verify with staff, and then a question. I wanted to confirm with staff that the 0305 does indeed have 40 of the officers continuing on in the actual 0305 budget.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, the governor's budget does provide funding for the 40 patrol troopers.
Thank you. And a question then to Mr. Buckhannis. If the state does not move forward under House Bill 5075 right now to gather up these officers, which have extensive training, who are available and are presently drawing, in some cases, unemployment, if the state does not move forward, Mr. Buckhannis, have you estimated what it may cost us to come back in 4 months and try and recapture any of those that might yet be left in the labor pool?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, yes, we have, and I've actually worked it out in two different formats. If you take solely the training process itself, from the day we start doing background investigations to the day we hire them and train them only, we'll have $50,000 to $60,000 per trooper invested in them. If you count their wages and salary for the first 12 months, because that is it is just intensive training for the first 12 months, we have invested over $100,000 per trooper to get them beyond that 12-month time frame.
So, final follow-up. So, the amount requested for the 40 officers to maintain them through this particular period of time is $500,000. And if I hear the testimony correctly, to be able to go back and purchase those officers, to buy them anew would cost something in the vicinity of $2 million. So this appears to be an excellent investment, $500,000, to save us $2 million in the future. Would that be correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I would concur with that.
Thank you very much.
Representative Hansen, did you have a question?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Your testimony. Susan King.
Good morning, Representative Miller, members of the committee. My name is Susan King, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Nurses Association. My clinical practice is in emergency nursing, and so for the last 4 or 5 years, I have been living every day with the consequences of some of our prior decisions about funding cuts for health care. Most specifically, every shift that I work in the emergency department, we have probably two or three mentally ill individuals who end up being brought to us by the police, being brought to us by their caregiver. Often they're violent. Often they have hurt themselves. Frequently they attempt to hurt other patients and staff. And so looking ahead at the budget cuts that we're facing now fills me with a sense of dread because it's all additive. I'm testifying today in support of this bill, not because it's a complete answer. I liken it to stabilizing the patient as they come through the front door until we can figure out how to deal with their health care problems. So I recognize that this is only a very small frame in a very long film, but I would like to offer my support. One of my colleagues that I talked to over the weekend asked if I would read this very brief story into the record. I know some of you probably met a young man who was here last week in the building who had received a new heart. This is a similar story, but I think it really points up the need to pass this bill and then move forward in a way that we can try to figure out this budget morass that we're in. This is from Ann Coleman, who is the owner of Havenwood West Adult Foster Home in Springfield, Oregon. Please accept this testimony related to a young man who was in my foster care home prior to receiving a kidney transplant. Kenneth Peters, a 30-year-old man, is currently an inpatient at Sacred Heart Hospital in Eugene. If you wish to speak with him, he's in room 305, and the direct phone number is listed in the testimony. Kenneth Peters did give his permission to use his name and his story before you today. Ken was a resident at my adult foster care home for several months while we prepared him to receive a kidney transplant. During that time, he went to dialysis 3 times a week. He finally qualified and received his kidney last May at OHSU. Following his transplant and his required stay in Portland, he returned to my home while he got himself back on his feet. He continued to have blood work done and was monitored for any signs or symptoms of rejection. Within a few months of taking his post-transplant medications, his health allowed him to return to work. He was employed at Staples in Eugene and was enjoying a welcome new lease on life. He still qualified for Medicare, but was on the medically needy program, which allowed him to purchase the insurance for his medications. That's at a cost to him of $140 per month. He received a letter the beginning of January informing him that he would no longer qualify for this program at the end of January. Some of his medications cost as much as $1,100 a month, and he knew there was no way he would be going to be able to earn enough money to afford this. As January drew to a close, he began to ration his medications, taking less than he was supposed to, hoping a solution would come along to help him with the cost. By the end of the first week of February, he was hospitalized and is now back to being dialyzed. It appears at this time that he's experiencing rejection of his newly implanted kidney. They're hoping to save the kidney, but it does not look very promising. This is an example of how quickly an organ can fail without the necessary medications. Along with the failed organ comes the return to dialysis 3 times a week and the inability to be employed as a member of our community. That, I know, is a story that is not unfamiliar to you, but I would say again in closing that although we recognize that this is not an answer, it is a short-term, very temporary fix, we would support doing this while we all move on to consider where we need to cut services. I'm very well aware of the questions, and I do know that all of us have a responsibility not to come to you to say simply fund this, but where does the money come from? And we, as an organization, will be very happy to work with you and try to identify some of those places. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Are there questions? Representative Bates.
Just very quickly, Mr. Chair. I assume the cost of dialysis, which he will probably face the rest of his life when the kidney fails, is going to be paid for by the state of Oregon and Medicaid?
My understanding is probably by Medicare.
Mm-hmm. And was there an attempt by him to access the medications he needed through the pharmaceutical industry's free drug program, TogetherRx or the others?
Yes, Representative Miller and Representative Bates, my understanding that he is attempting to do that, but the short time frame given to him for the discontinuation of the medically needy program didn't allow him to complete that process, but my understanding is he is working on that at this point.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, for your questions. Thank you for your testimony. Janine Delaney? Did I do that right? Maybe not.
Chair Miller and committee members, for the record, my name is Janine Delaney, and I'm with the Oregon Disabilities Commission. And much like the last speaker, I'm here in support of this bill, not because it's the right answer or the best answer, but because it's the only one we've heard to date. And we receive dozens of calls each day from Oregonians who are at risk of losing not only medically needy supports, but other services, who are desperate to know what they're going to do. And it's in their behalf that I come to you today speaking in support of at least beginning the dialogue on restoring these critical services, or as they're called, lethal cuts to people with disabilities and others that really depend on these services for their very lives. And in anticipation of questions, I guess I would say the Commission has tried to look at revenue options, and we haven't come to any brilliant conclusions, but have been in basic support of trying to look at increasing revenue in the state.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions? Thank you again. Mary Botkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Mary Botkin, representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. And we have, as you know, historically been one of those groups at the table who pointed out what we think are efficiencies that can be gained in our agencies. We share some of Mr. Botwinus's concerns, and I emphasize the term some. You know, we too have seen our public safety budget shrink biennium after biennium after biennium. We have not seen a current service level budget in a number of bienniums, and that means cuts and reductions, and we've done what we can to balance out those reductions internally within our budgets, and I think we played a fairly productive role in identifying areas that could be cut back or changed or services delivered in a different manner. Ballot Measure 28, which was, you know, obviously put on the ballot by the legislature, was a measure in which our union participated very generously in a financial manner, but it is also a measure that our members committed to on a personal level and worked diligently to, if nothing else, narrow the gap. And in the last couple of weeks, I think we actually thought we could push it over the top. And I think that this House bill or this budget proposal in front of you provides us some relief. It provides some relief to some of the worst areas. You know, we don't represent uniformed officers that are going to benefit from this. But we do have mental health clients that will benefit from this. We have folks who, without this additional money, will die. And, you know, I had a conversation with a colleague in which, you know, they said, well, you know, there's a dilemma about whether or not we ought to let people die on the streets in order to make our point. And I said, you know, there's a point where trauma is undoable. And our members provide the services to the most critically needed folks in the community. And a trauma is when you watch on the 5 o'clock news one of your clients trying to jump off of the bridge and see a Portland police officer risking his life to save theirs, only to have them succeed the next day. A trauma is when you go to work in the morning and find one of your clients hanging from a bridge waiting to be cut down. That's a trauma. And it is a trauma that this bill will at least mitigate. It's not going to solve anything, but it will mitigate some of the worst cases. And Absentee Council 75 is prepared to support this bill not because it's a great solution, but because every solution we've tried so far hasn't gotten us there. And, you know, this plugs a few holes. It doesn't plug them all. You know, there's still going to be some bad guys get out. And there's going to be some people who don't get services. It is my hope that with the little bit of money that's in this bill that we can at least keep some of our clients from facing fairly ugly futures in a very short period of time. And, you know, we're the union that represents everybody, you know. We've got the human services folks. We've got the public safety folks. We've got, you know, we even have the coroners. So if worse comes to worse, you know, they'll at least get the bodies. You know, I mean, this is really very serious stuff that this committee is dealing with. And, you know, we hope that we can solve some of the problems and give us some time to find some longer-term solutions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mary, in seeking solutions, our first witness of the day, or well, not first, but Mr. Cox suggested the implementation of the updated mortality tables with respect to PERS and alluded to some savings. What is your position on that?
We supported updating the mortality tables in the first, second, third, fourth, and fifth special sessions and in the last regular session. And, you know, we've always supported updating the mortality tables in a rational manner. And I would suggest that if we had done what we had suggested, what the PERS Coalition suggested that we do in the last regular session and maybe the session before that, we would have saved about $1.5 billion already. And, you know, we are always in support of updating mortality tables when it is done in a responsible manner, which protects people's current contract rights, but also protects things and makes changes into the future. And we believe that the PERS Coalition on several occasions has offered, as has our lawyer, offered solutions that would have faced little legal challenge. Those solutions, however, were not. Those were those solutions that we've offered on several occasions over the years were opposed by our employers, and unfortunately, they lack constitutional requirements in both chambers, and we couldn't get to 16, and neither could they.
Representative Bates.
Thank you. Just a follow-up question in the line of questioning you start here. The figure that that was thrown at us this morning was $50 million annually could be saved if the actuarial tables were implemented.
Do you agree? Everybody has a number.
What figure would you agree with at this point?
You know, it's a, as you know, Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, as you know, it is a moving number that... you know, nobody told me that I had to be able to count beyond 16 and 31 when I took this job 18 years ago. And, you know, there's this guy that's an actuary. He's a lot smarter than I am, and even his numbers change periodically. So I'm not going to presume to know something that somebody who is certified smart in numbers can't give us a solid answer on.
Thank you, Mary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for being here. Philip Kennedy Wong.
Mr. Chairman, I was wondering if I could accept the class with the next person, Anthony Bernard. Be pleased to have you both. Thank you.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Phil Kennedy Wong. I represent Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, an association of 17 Christian denominations with close to 1,000 churches statewide. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 5075.
Thank you.
And we would like to thank the legislative leadership for introducing House Bill 5075. Ever since the state's economic downturn began, Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, along with other religious organizations here, have advocated for protecting the social safety net. House Bill 5075 represents an acknowledgement of the social safety net. As a social service agency, but primarily as a religious organization, our community ministry comes out of moral imperative. We recognize the body of services that we hold sacred as a social safety net for all Oregonians. And these services must protect the most vulnerable in our state and benefit us all as a society. These services must be safe from the fluctuations of our local, national, and global economy. And most importantly, the social safety net must be shielded from politics and partisanship. We ask that when you consider House Bill 5075 that you take a close examination of potentially other services that would have lethal consequences. And I would like to agree with what Representative Butler said in terms of his statement regarding investing in the Portland, in the state police. The other day I got a call from our manager of our HIV Day Center, which is a center that serves low-income patients who are afflicted with the HIV disease. And many of these patients, these clients, human beings will be losing their services, and I would urge you to consider taking a look at the potential human impact, but also the financial impact of people who are on the Oregon Health Plan prescription drug benefit, who may lose their benefits, and as a result, may actually end up costing the state more money in the long run because of the higher cost of health care that these individuals losing these benefits would occur. So please consider this example and as a way to look at how we budget our money, but at the same time not lose sight of the moral imperative. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee, for the record, my name is Anthony Granados, representing the Oregon Catholic Conference. The Oregon Catholic Conference represents the Catholic bishops in Oregon in service to the people of Oregon, promotion of the common good. and we are also here, like my friend, in support of House Bill 5075. And we're very thankful for this move because it's a move in the right direction for this state to protect the most vulnerable citizens of our state. And we definitely understand the constraints and the political implications of such a move and where the state is going in the future. But we're here to advocate on behalf of the most vulnerable, the most needy. Not only is this a compassionate move on behalf of the religious community, but it's also a rational one. When you think of the long-term cost to the state, for example, as we've seen people being let out of prison, without the level 15 through 17, even though this doesn't provide for that, and the reduction and the elimination of OPI, that would also have long-term effects beneficial to our state. So we think this is generally in the right direction. We're very supportive and thankful for the speaker. Since the beginning of this session, she has spoken about the most vulnerable and the needy, and we're very thankful for this. It's not a perfect solution, but it's a necessary one. It's a move in the right direction. Of course, there are other programs that will not be affected by this that we would like to see restored, such as OPI, such as general assistance, and restoring the level 15 through 17 cuts that affect, for example, like in the handout of our assisted living facilities, Assumption Village and St. Anthony's Village. But just to state for the record again, the Oregon Catholic Conference is very supportive of this. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you both for your testimony. Are there questions? Thank you. Tamara, is it Sale?
Right.
That easy?
S-A-L.
Welcome.
My name is Tamara Sale, and I'm the coordinator for the Early Assessment and Support Team, or EAST, which covers Lynn, Marion, Polk, Yamhill, and Tillamook counties, and a resident of Beaverton, Oregon. The EAST program serves young people who are in the early stages of psychosis. And for those of you who are not familiar with psychosis, it's a neurochemical disorder which affects a person's ability to discern reality. And so these are individuals who are experiencing hallucinations, thought disorder, that sort of thing. In the 2 years that we've been doing this work, it's become very clear that the consequences which occur for a person with this type of illness occur very rapidly. They occur during a time of the person's life when the developmental consequences are very severe, even if we are able to help them stabilize potentially, because they're college students, they're young people who are in the early stages of work, sometimes they're high school students. And virtually everyone in our program at this point has been stabilized successfully, and they're back in school, they're working. Some of them are having a little bit harder time, but they're all moving in a positive direction. I'm here, of course, in support of this bill, and I also want to thank you for the leadership which you have accepted in applying a principle, which is that that we need to prioritize the decisions that we make based on the impact on human life. I haven't heard that previously coming from the legislature or from the governor's office. And so I think as an individual, I've accepted the responsibility of what leadership I can provide, and I appreciate you all doing the same. As far as the medically needy program, the announcement that people received about the cut came 20 days prior to the cut actually happening. That didn't allow people enough time to even contact the pharmaceutical companies. Typically, they take 4 to 6 weeks to respond to a request. So individuals have been making decisions about which medicine to stop taking based on how much it costs them. They are in a very clear dilemma. They don't have a lot of choices. And I'll also say that in my program, the rate of uninsurance is going to go from 10% to 80% as of March 1st. Fortunately, we have some foundation funding, we're hoping to be able to preserve some of the case management and psychiatric services, but most of the people in our program will no longer have the ability to pay for their prescriptions through any kind of health insurance. And I can give you a long list of the consequences that we've experienced just in the early stages before we became involved. including a range of we had a person die, suicide attempts, people ingesting poison, thinking that that was okay, that they could, you know, eat poison and that it would be safe. The inability to distinguish between what's safe and what's not safe. So the emergency room nurse who spoke, I think, really demonstrated for you the impact. Imagine if she's having two people come in right now. Soon it will be five. And so whatever we can do. Also, I'll mention that with the Oregon Health Plan standard cut to prescription coverage, which is due to take effect on March 1st, to my knowledge, no one has yet received any notice that that's going to occur. I think that that is that demonstrates a lack of concern for the public responsibility that we all hold. And that's another issue that is not directly addressed in this bill, but I would like to see some kind of requirement that people receive adequate notification so they can at least request assistance from pharmaceutical companies. And, of course, within the mental health system, I'll also mention the elimination of the general assistance program, the indigent care, all the funds for indigent care has gone away, and also all of the money to the outpatient mental health crisis system has been eliminated as well. So that just compounds the impact of this particular cut. So, and I know people are interested in what can be restored, and I would encourage you to publicly make a commitment to finding those answers. I've seen a range of things from adding a tax to hotels to keeping the unredeemed deposits on pop cans to an alcohol and drug tax, and I know each one of those is only a small amount of money, but incrementally those things could potentially really add up, along with recognizing that many of these cuts that we're looking at happened because the governor had limited authority, and with the legislature's discretion, potentially you could find some places where cuts could be made, like maybe having people work 4 days a week for a while or something like that. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there questions? Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry to be asking so many questions,
problem.
But I'll move this along as quickly as I can. This bill has been criticized by some members of the legislature as not really dealing with the problems we need to be dealing with. And by that I mean it's, the medically needy program has been criticized as not really being people who are most medically needy in the state. And that cutting off these people from these benefits will not really lead to anybody's death. The question I want answered, if you can for me in your group you're dealing with, you think one that will lead to death if we cut these funds off the next 3 weeks? Two, do you feel these people are significantly more needy than others? And three, if these people do apply to pharmaceutical companies to get these drugs, will most of them qualify? Will some of them qualify? Or will some of them not qualify?
Well, I think that this is an extremely high-risk group. I think, you know, in comparison to the indigent care group or even some of the people on Oregon Health Plan Standard, there are individuals who are probably at an equally high level of risk. But I think that it's definitely worthwhile to restore the support for these individuals. I think that, you know, some of these individuals will receive pharmaceutical coverage given enough time. But the pharmaceutical programs are kind of a patchwork. Some of them are only temporary, some of them are long term, and we have had people apply to those programs and be turned down. So there's certainly no guarantee. But I think that to at least extend the coverage will allow those individuals who are working with people to help them get through that process. As it stands right now, I helped to co-facilitate a women's group, and three of those women have now been basically cut out of their mental health services totally. So they no longer have case management or anyone there to help them work through that process. So, you know, there are a lot of uncertainties about what people could potentially do and believe me, everyone is scrambling to come up with any solution they can come up with. I think that at least restoring the funding temporarily would allow people to analyze the situation and be a little more prepared to deal with it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 5075? It will be the Chair's intention at the close of testimony that we will end the public hearing and begin a work session on this measure.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Grover Simmons. I represent the Adult Care Providers of Oregon, a Adult Foster Home Association, and also Hoodview, a residential care facility. Normally, when I testify before any committee, I come prepared with a script and lots of verbatim stuff. Today, I don't have that, but I did want to say I think I could. I'd like to put into the record just an idea of how you may find money to finance this $15.3 million. With respect to adult foster homes, however, I've been advised by the Department of Seniors and People with Disabilities that levels 15, 16, and 17, Medicaid eligibility levels 15, 16, 17, when those are eliminated, that will render 100 residents in foster homes ineligible for further service. And if they go from through levels 10 to 14, another 525 people will be made ineligible for Medicaid. So we're looking at 625 people out of the adult foster home industry. I didn't come here to talk about that today, Mr. Chairman. Secondly, Hoodview is one of the members of Independent Employer Association, and Hoodview is owned by Dennis Murphy. He tells me that there are 56 people in his in Hoodview, many of whom came out of Fairview. They are truly the most handicapped people you could see. He's been advised that his facility will be closed. That's all general fund money. There's no federal match, and that's why he got hit first. We're trying to do something about that, but nevertheless, 56 people in Hoodview will be adversely affected. They would, if this bill were to pass, they would be... there would be money to keep Hoodview open a while longer. But what I really wanted to do, however, was to get down to the point of where are you going to find the money? That's the essence of the problem. And how do you deal with the roll-up costs, as Representative Bates raised that point earlier. Two or three days ago, Representative Butler, I mentioned that I believe that the Judge Lipscomb's decision with respect to actuarial tables ought to be read and implemented. And he said, "Would you write a white paper? Write me a white paper on that." Well, I don't have the white paper, but I do have some rough notes, if you will. Here is the. How many of you read the full decision by Judge Lipscomb? One. Well, it is laborious. The essence of it, however, is in just about a page and a half. And with your indulgence, Mr. Chair, may I just put that in? I don't want to use words that are not absolutely what the judge said, and it's only a page and a half. It's 2 minutes. It is apparent.
Under a call right now, but okay.
It is apparent from the case of striking, from the use of striking similar language throughout the operative statutes, that the legislature placed substantial importance on the means of actuarial equivalency in establishing members' retirement benefits in a parity with their contributions. In implementing this, he talks a little bit more about actuarial equivalency. The actual practice of the board has not been faithful to this legislative mandate for some time. Rather, the board has maintained its reliance on mortality tables dating back to 1978, despite consistent evidence that the members' mortality was gradually improving, and that as a result of the retired members living longer, the retirement benefits for new retirees would need to be reduced in order to maintain actuarial equivalency. The reliance on the 1978 tables has continued despite periodic recommendations from the board's own actuary to adopt more modern mortality tables. Indeed, in 1993, the board went so far as to promulgate an administrative rule stating that the board would not adopt more current mortality tables unless doing so would produce a higher monthly benefit for members, and he cites the statute. It is the conclusion of this court that the board has acted improperly in refusing to update mortality tables, has abused its discretion in failing to follow the legislative mandate to maintain actuarial equivalency when determining retirement benefits. None of the, so forth. That's it. He finally gets down and he says, it's too little, it's too late. The last sentence, the board has a duty to comply with a statutory mandate immediately and fully. Well, what does that really mean? If we did that, we could go back to what I call the date of declared illegality. I gather you're on a call.
No longer.
We should go back. Oh, well, I'll slow down then. Thank you.
Not necessary, Grover.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Anyway, how can we implement the judge's decision? First of all, Representative Knope has indicated he's not happy with the PERS board's suggestion that they will not implement new tables until the end of 2003. And there's another alternative that he wasn't too satisfied with. So what are you going to do? What are you going to do? That's what triggered my meeting with Representative Butler. So I thought, well, why don't you just go back to the point of the date of declared illegality, which would be when the decision was rendered, which is like October of 2002. But I think more appropriately, go back to the time that the lawsuit was initiated and say that's the starting point to put the actuarial tables into effect. One final point, there was testimony before a committee last week by Richard Leonetti, a very experienced and respected researcher in these matters, and his message was a failure to update PERS monthly mortality tables costing taxpayers $3 million per day. So, Mr. Chairman, you're looking for $15.3 million. You can solve this problem by Friday afternoon in one flip sense. I'm not, I don't recognize that. But the testimony about dealing with $50 million and so forth, of course, those are the big numbers. And if you do what the court says to do and you implement the tables immediately, that doesn't mean way down the line. You have that option before you. All you have to do is really bite the bullet, go back to the date of illegality, and your decision would be completely justified. Thank you so very much.
Thank you. Questions? Thanks for your testimony. All right, that is the last witness that is signed up for House Bill 5075. Anyone else wishing to testify? If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 5075. We'll open a work session on House Bill 5075. Is there a discussion? Representative Patridge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I wanted to say that I applaud the Speaker for bringing this bill forward because people's lives do hang in the balance, and I think we as a legislature have not only a moral and ethical obligation, but an obligation to act swiftly to help these people's lives to make sure that they have stability, at least through this tough spot that we're in right now. The Speaker prioritized and took a very close look at those programs which were important. These are programs that we can't just turn the spigot on and off for state government. She prioritized those programs so that we wouldn't eliminate our current investment like the state police. or throw people out on the street, like in the mental health program and medically needy programs. She tried to prioritize so that we didn't cut off our nose to spite our face in terms of what we're doing for the current biennium. But I think it's important that what gets lost in this whole debate about whether this is a good bill or shouldn't go forward or should go forward is that we have to go back to House Bill 5100 and the environment that each of us who are sitting on this committee sat in here in the legislature. House Bill 5100 was a bill that achieved the political aims and goals of a particular group of people who had an opportunity to have a majority to move something forward during that legislative session. House Bill 5100 put in across-the-board cuts with the aim of passing what ultimately became Measure 28. House Bill 5100 and some of its unintended consequences were not intended to be great state policy, were not intended to solve the state's problems. It had political aims and goals in mind to move forward. I was one of those people who supported Measure 28 and 5100 as they moved through the system. I think that we need to go, I don't think that it's the solution, but we need to go back and look at revenue. We need to look at where our state is. I also think we need to reprioritize. But by the same token, House Bill 5100 and the members that sat around this table and the members of the legislature didn't feel like that was the solution to the problem. That's not what I believe. I believe that those who are going forward and saying let the cuts stand have a little bit of a dose of revisionist history. We're here to make very critical decisions. And this bill that the Speaker proposed in House Bill 5075, basically I look at as first aid. We have identified the money. She has identified the pots. It's now time to administer that first aid and then take the time to triage the patient and make the cuts. We can't sit here and hide behind where are we going to get the money, what are we going to do right now. We all know that it was a very difficult situation, but the governor had one aim in mind when he tried to move a tax, which ultimately became Measure 28, and that was to go out and make some pretty severe cuts and signpost to the voters that they were going to do that. Well, I think in retrospect, maybe that's not what would have been done, and that wasn't the best political approach to passing a measure. I think Oregonians felt like there was a gun to their head and that we needed to better prioritize and better spend state funds. We didn't deal with the public employee retirement system issue. We didn't deal with some of the other issues, which I believe probably would have added more credibility to the legislature and would have provided more credibility to provide for the impassioned plea under Measure 28, which is what ultimately became the 5100 cuts. I think we have an obligation to govern. I think we have identified the first aid in order to provide these critical services to our most severely disabled as well as those in our population so that we're not throwing away the investment that we've made. I think we've been able to provide the first aid. Now's the time to stop the bleeding. We can triage the patient later. We can make some decisions later. But those who hide behind the cuts right now, I don't believe it's an ethical or moral way to go about governing when we all knew when 5100 passed that wasn't where we were trying to set state policy. That was an opportunity for political aims and goals to be achieved. So I'm not going to stand here and fiddle while Rome burns while we look for cuts. We have the opportunity to marshal resources. We have the opportunity to take the temperature of the state. $15 million in one-time funds is nothing compared to what we have done before. It is nothing compared to many of the bills that passed through this legislative body, who I think almost all members of this committee voted for, whether that was borrowing on the tobacco settlement or other items. $15 million is not a lot, but it is a lot for those whose lives hang in the balance, and I think it's critically important that we pass the bill and we think about, as we vote on this bill, how we got to the situation that we're in today, which often gets left out.
Thanks. Should I take that as a motion to move House Bill 5075 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation?
I move House Bill 5075 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation, Mr. Chair.
And moved. Is there further discussion? Representative Bates.
I agree with my colleague from Southern Oregon for most of what he said, not completely. but I do agree that we need to move this bill forward. Unfortunately, the situation we're facing now is different than it was, I think, substantially different than it was 3 weeks ago. And this bill is a step in the right direction, but we need to go much further. We are looking at, as I said earlier, a probable $300 million shortfall in the next few months. Discussion even 2 weeks ago was that we were not going to open up 5100, we were not going to open up the 0103 budget. I think we're going to be forced to do both now, and rightfully so. We've got 100,000 Oregonians that are going to lose their pharmaceutical benefits and mental health benefits in the next few months, no matter what we do with this bill. And those people will be hurt just as badly as the ones we're trying to help now. I think that we have to look very broadly at the budget when we do this, and if we are truly not going to be raising new revenue, which I don't see any chance of in the 0103 budget, we have to be honest about our decision to be made here. And we're talking about large and substantial cuts to K-12, large substantial cuts to the urban health plans we know of today. We're looking at changes and corrections. You can't take $300 million out of this budget without having some serious pain out there, pain that goes far beyond 5100. It's going to be some hard decision making, and unfortunately I think it's going to have to happen in a very short length of time, probably the next few weeks, to get this behind us. And when you have that kind of a rush on you, mistakes can be made and probably will be made, and I caution us as we go through these cuts to think of that, because we're probably going to be having a lot of unforeseen consequences from the decisions we're going to make in the next few weeks and the pain we're going to bring to Oregonians. Having said that, I look forward to working with my colleagues on this. I will support this bill on the floor. I do want it to go into a larger discussion of ways and means, however, not just stand alone. We need to discuss this, the entire picture we're now facing in the state. And I would recommend that we take it to the floor, that we vote it out. We know it's going to the Senate. I would hope the Senate would put it into a Ways and Means Committee there and look at it and discuss it there as a priority, not let it die. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I agree with both of my colleagues from Southern Oregon that have spoken that this, in fact, as Representative Bates has indicated, does open the dialogue. And I think Measure 28 has proven that Oregonians are typically very poor hostages, that we did not agree that there weren't options available to us as we got to this particular point. And I agree also with the comments that have been made indicating that it's time for us to go ahead and mend the safety net, and that gives us an opportunity to do that. And I appreciate the fact that we've got 40 troopers that are part of this, which, not being a wagering man, I would say that that's a pretty good bet. I'd put pretty good money on the $500,000 that we're willing to expend to keep 40 troopers, anticipating that they're already in the budget. And would have cost us something four times this amount if we were in a position to have to retrain them from scratch. So I think that this is very responsible. I would say, however, I'm wearing my beef. It's what's for dinner hat. You know what that's for. These cuts that are being made in 5100 are not across the board. They are targeted to rural communities, and that is most damaging to my constituents in Harney County. I believe that there are opportunities for us, and there are other bills out there that give us an opportunity to seek other funds, including, I think, Representative Mary Gallegos has a bill to take a look at the public purpose safety charge, public purpose charge in the Department of Public Utilities, to examine those funds to be utilized to keep some of the most egregious of the OIA criminals off the street, because we're going to need these state troopers just to ride herd over some of these young folks that will be released. If you take a look at the released list and the crimes that these youngsters have been put in to the Oregon Youth Authority for, these young people will be back and need to have the supervision, and that's part of the balloon that we're squeezing that will be filled out in another spot. So with that, Mr. Chair and colleagues, I do express the concern that the Oregon Youth Authority needs to be also addressed, because there are some folks there that will cause us a great deal more grief as a result of the fact that they are being put out on the streets without supervision. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I too want to just kind of extend my thoughts on the bill. I think my colleagues today have done a very good job of bringing out the downside risks of the bill because of the economic environment that we find ourselves in. We're still clearly in declining revenue territory and have to be very thoughtful as we move forward on this. We also have roll-up issues with this. I remember very clearly when Representative Patridge was discussing the scene under which 5100 was staged, the animosity that we felt then and the difficulty that we had in coming to any kind of resolution that could get the votes to get through the process. And clearly 5100 was not a statement of state policy. It was an attempt to balance the budget and really nothing more than that. As we tried to deal with these issues through the rest of the interim and with the emergency board, we were constantly frustrated by the statutory constraints that we faced and the inability of the emergency board to deal in a meaningful way with the situation that we had. I think that all of us, because we all are budget people, you're looking here at probably some of the people that are going to be very pivotal on the House side in figuring a way out of this on the 03-05 budget time, I think we recognize very clearly that there are no silver bullets here. There's no more rabbits that we can pull out of the hat, that we've done all the easy things and we've done all the politically expedient things, and that this is a difficult bill. But I think that the other side of the coin is that we do have a moral responsibility as legislators and as citizens of Oregon and as people to protect the most vulnerable people in the state. And I think that this bill just gives us that band-aid to bring this into the kind of discussion that we need to have in the legislative arena about how we are going to frame services in 03-05. It just is a kind of a bridge that takes some very vulnerable people through a very horrible and scary time in their lives. I think that we do clearly recognize that we face an unprecedented situation. We're in uncharted waters, and we can't pull a cookbook down off the shelf and figure out how to get out of this one. But I think that we are very focused on the need to discuss every program that the state offers and to look at it in terms of what it does for the people of the state of Oregon and whether this is a time to continue funding those programs or not. And I don't think that any of us know what lies ahead of us and how we're going to solve these problems, but I think that we do have a good grasp on the magnitude of the situation that we face, and I think that we are ready to go forward. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will very definitely be in support of this bill.
Thank you, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To paraphrase, I think it's Woody Allen who once said, one road leads to nuclear despair, nuclear destruction, and the other road leads to total despair and humiliation, and we must carefully decide which fork of the road to take. Our two choices here are probably poor fiscal policy that doesn't lead to help us with our total budget woes that seem to be growing worse every day, or turning our backs on the most vulnerable citizens in the state of Oregon. And that's an incredibly difficult decision to make. I cannot turn my back on those citizens. So, but I do it fully realizing that this may make our budget situation worse. It will be difficult to sustain into the next biennium. But I think it's the only choice that we can make at this time. I'm afraid we're going to be making these types of decisions, sometimes heart over responsibility, until we can come to grips with total tax reform. Our tax system that drives the state budget simply does not produce enough revenue in the types of ways that we continue programs that are absolutely a necessity for for vulnerable Oregonians and are needed by the rest of Oregonians just to maintain a basic quality of life. So until we come to grips with tax reform, I think we're going to have to be making these difficult decisions, and decisions that that are going to be growing harder and harder to make as we get deeper into this budget. But on this particular set of decisions, I'll vote with my heart.
Thank you, Representative. Further discussion? You don't have to.
Mr. Chair, I want it noted for the record I have nothing to add.
Well, you always do, just by being here.
I like to have it noted for the record, that's a first.
Well, let me just echo a lot of the sentiments of the members of this committee, and I also, in frankly, listening to each of you and your participation this morning is a source of my optimism about the budget that we will produce, because I think, and I've said this in front of the full Ways and Means Committee, a committee that all of these members are members of, I think we have the most able members of this assembly on that committee dealing with the most difficult problem this state has faced, certainly in the 20 years I've been here. I think their thoughtfulness, their pensiveness, their ability to grasp and understand the challenge is something that will serve us well in the coming months. Let me also say that the suggestions that we received, Mr. Simmons, Mr. Cox, Mr. Botwinis, and others, are important to the discussion, because as Representative Bates has pointed out and was discussed in a meeting that I attended this morning with the governor and others, the forecast could be as much as $300 million short this biennium. In the words of the governor when he took office, it cannot be business as usual. We can't just give a passing glance to whether or not mortality tables should be adopted by the end of the week. That has to be a real prospect if we are to save the most vulnerable. And we can't just delay and deny. So what I ask you and everybody else who might be tuning into this kind of a hearing is, when you, yes, want to represent the interests of those who need our help, please also use your intelligence with the contacts that you have with our government about those things that perhaps aren't serving us as efficiently as they might, those things that aren't absolutely critical, those programs that could be suspended at the end of this week and for the next biennium. We have our own lists and ideas, but we are greatly assisted by Oregonians like you who are involved enough to be in this room today, who will contact others and help us through this difficult challenge. And let me also say that there have been those to date who have expressed some opposition to this bill. Let me tell you that they do so for good faith reasons. They do not lack compassion. They have a complete understanding of the budget crisis we are in. And their hesitation to support this bill is not because they care less about the most vulnerable. Is because they are ready to embark in the most difficult decisions we will have, and that is trying to get a handle on this budget. So I ask you to respect their dissent when it comes, and understand their motivation. But I want to tell you, it's not their lack of compassion that may cast a no vote. They're deeply caring people, or they wouldn't be here. So that Representative Patridge has moved that we send House Bill 5075 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Is there well, I guess we better call the roll on this one. The clerk would call the roll, please.
Representative Butler?
Aye.
Representative Patridge?
Aye.
Representative Hansen?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Bates?
Aye.
Vice Chair Martin?
Aye.
Chair Miller?
Votes aye. House Bill 5075 is passed to the House floor.
We will close the public here, or the work session on House Bill 5075. The speaker is asked to carry this bill. We'll give her that privilege, and with that, the committee is adjourned.
Excuse me?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think they're just gabbling.